abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Thursday, December 5th, 2013. And today we are going to tackle an interesting and important question. And that is, what did people do before the welfare state? Good question. What did they do before there was a welfare state in the United States, particularly in the 20th century? What did people do to care for themselves, to care for each other? It's a good question. We hardly ever get an answer, but today we're going to get an answer because we're going to be talking to David Beto, who's the author of From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State, which is a study precisely of what it is people did to care for each other in the age before the welfare state. A brief note, though, before we get to Professor Beto. Tomorrow I am hoping to get to my program on Pope Francis, but I'll tell you, I just hosted the Peter Schiff Show today. I'm hosting again on Monday, by the way. And I've got these 8 gazillion videos that I have to record for ronpaulhomeschool.com, and I'm just being stretched in all directions. I'm going to do my very best to get that program out of my system and into your ears tomorrow. So we will see. Also, around the time of Black Friday, that whole weekend into Cyber Monday, I was promoting a 35% off deal for gift subscriptions to mylibertyclassroom.com. Well, that's over, but you guys are my best supporters, people who listen into the program regularly. You're the best. I appreciate that. It's really great of you to do that. So I have a secret ongoing deal just for you guys. So I'm not publicizing this anywhere else. So if you go to libertyclassroom.com/secret, it's the same offer, but it's a secret page just for you guys. So if there is somebody on your list who could benefit from a lifeline to sane professors, you can ask us questions for a full year in your subscription, not to mention the courses themselves, then you can get 35% off a gift subscription to libertyclassroom.com at libertyclassroom.com/secret. Okay, let's turn now to David Beto. David Beto is the author of this book we're going to talk about today, From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State. He is a professor of history at the University of Alabama, and I am very glad to welcome him right now. David Beto, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
You know, the last...
Big fan.
Thank you. I think we saw each other at a straw poll. If you remember back in 2007, it was like the West Alabama GOP straw poll, and you happened to be there, and I was there with my wife, and there were 250 people there, and 200 of them were all for Ron Paul, and it was, I think, the first time that you and I realized that something kind of funny is going on here in this campaign.
Yeah, there were these dazed Huckabee and Romney supporters wandering around too, which was kind of amusing, to actually beat these people at something.
Right, exactly. And in fact, it seemed to me like, at least with some of the candidates, that it was almost a certainty they were being paid to be there, whereas by contrast, we would have paid to be there. Like, anyway, we had a great time. And just so they couldn't steal the vote for us, I remember some guy came around with a camera asking each person, "Do you support Ron Paul, or which candidate do you support?" And I was wearing a T-shirt and like a hat, and he's asking me which candidate I support. So I told him I'm still kind of on the fence. But anyway, that was fun.
I got a great quotation out of it. Some reporter, I said, "Where's the support? Where's the support for these people?" And it was just so obvious. And very little support, at least very little enthusiasm. I think that's what I said. Where is the enthusiasm?
Exactly.
Very little on the other side.
Yeah, and it never. That didn't go away in 2012 either. No enthusiasm for Tim Pawlenty, that's for sure. All right, well, I want to turn to this book of yours. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've written numerous books, but it was this work where I first became familiar with you, because I read some of the papers that eventually turned into this book all the way back in the 1990s. And the book is From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State, Fraternal Societies and Social Services, 1890 to 1967. And what's so valuable about this book is not only the rich texture and detail that you're providing here, but you are filling in the very important gap, which is, what did people do before there was a welfare state? And I think the reigning assumption is they just keeled over and died. And you show there was a whole world out there, a whole parallel universe where people arranged their affairs and provided for themselves and for each other. So, how did you come upon this topic? Because you came upon all kinds of interesting sources and records that I'm not sure most people were even aware existed.
Well, I was thinking of looking at philanthropy, the history of philanthropy, and I was talking to Tom Palm, the Institute for Humane Studies, and he said, you know, you ought to read this book about British fraternal societies or British friendly societies. It was done by a guy named David Green. And I read this, and then there was some similar work that he did on the Australian friendly societies, through the American counterparts of fraternal societies, and they did all these, you know, things. They had health care and provided this robust social welfare system through mutual aid. And I thought, well, I wonder if there's anything like this in the United States. So just looked up a few encyclopedia entries and saw an indication, yes, yeah, we did have these organizations in the United States, and looked deeper and deeper into it and found an array of social welfare services covering everything from unemployment insurance to orphanages to homes for the elderly to hospitals, and just dove right into it. And it was really quite remarkable to the extent to which historians have ignored this topic. So it provided me an opportunity, which is great for a historian to be a trailblazer, simply because it was a neglected topic.
And these days, when there are so many historians and so many people getting PhDs, and people are writing about tiny little slivers of history that are of interest only to specialists, to be able to indeed blaze a trail on a topic that would be of interest to the general public and certainly obviously of interest to libertarians is a tremendous opportunity. So let's talk a little bit about this. When we talk about fraternal organizations here, what do we mean? What are examples of fraternal organizations? What were their primary functions?
Well, these groups you see all around you today, but they're really much reduced, and they're mostly now just sort of social clubs. And these would be groups like the Elks and the Odd Fellows, the Knights of Pythias, and then a lot of the immigrant groups. Virtually every immigrant group would have a fraternal society, Sons of Italy, various Jewish organizations, Black organizations. In fact, the role these groups played among Blacks, I think, has been shamefully ignored. If anything, these groups were biggest among Blacks in the United States, bigger than among whites. Yet it's part of that history that's not written about. Well, what would these groups do? They had a ritual. They would be supported through membership dues. They were very decentralized to lodges. Sometimes they would have thousands of lodges scattered throughout the United States. And they would have a social function, certainly. This was often in a community where the dances were, where the sporting events were, sometimes where the bars were, would be the lodge. But they also used this as a method to provide mutual insurance, social welfare services, including health insurance and orphanages. But it wasn't charity, and it wasn't governmental relief. It was something different. In fact, they rejected the label charity. They said, we are mutual aid. It's reciprocity. You might be getting aid one day, and you may be receiving it another. But it's a sort of a benefit of membership.
Now, today, when you talk to somebody in a fraternal organization, you know, he'll talk about his fellow lodge brothers. You know, they have even if they haven't met yet, they feel like they have a special kind of connection. So, is it this kind of thing that makes people Was there some kind of a psychological aspect that knit everybody together? Because, you know, you would think that people would need to be in families or in immediate face-to-face neighborhood situations to be engaged in mutual aid. But, how big are these lodges?
Well, this is why, sometimes we hear these terms as historians, community and fraternity. And there really are different things. Community is something that, you can define these things any way you want, but I would associate community as something geographical, where you do have these kinds of, people in your neighborhood, your friends, right? People you associate on a day-to-day basis. And fraternity is a concept, I think, that transcends geography. And so if you're a member of the Odd Fellows, right, you feel a sense of fraternity with fellow Odd Fellows throughout the country. And when you move, let's say you move from Philadelphia to San Francisco, what often happened in the 19th century is you would take a transfer card with you from your home lodge, and you would link in immediately with the Odd Fellows in another city, and you get the benefits of a fraternal membership. So these groups really kind of saw themselves as surrogate families in some sense. And you have this this language of family, brotherhood and sisterhood, because fraternal societies included women's organizations. That's the term they used as well.
Now tell us about how healthcare was part of this. Now obviously healthcare was much less sophisticated in those days than it is today. But nevertheless, one of the features that is going to stand out to anybody reading this book of lodge membership included a kind of rudimentary health insurance. How did they work that out, and what did that consist of?
Well, you got to understand that part of this was because we did not have our current system, which as heavily subsidizes insurance provided through employers. That really started in a big way in World War II with tax exemptions for fringe benefits, or the state, which of course started to some extent earlier. These two sources. So, in an era where there wasn't really that kind of discrimination, a lot of the health insurance was purchased by individuals, and the main source of health insurance, say turn of the last century, was fraternal insurance. And the way they do it is the lodge would hire, the most rudimentary thing was they would hire a doctor and they would pay him a fee based on the size of the membership. So let's say you had 1,000 members in the lodge, that doctor would get $1,000 a year. And doctors would often compete for these lodge contracts. And they'd have elections where the members of the lodge would choose the doctor they wanted to be their lodge doctor. And they would be paid a certain flat fee, and this would include medicines, it would include house calls. And then you had a lot of lodges, even more commonly before this, would provide cash sick benefits. So if you were sick, the lodge would pay you a certain stipend each week that you were sick. And they would send members over, a visiting committee over to your house to make sure you were sick, that you weren't cheating the organization. And that was an advantage they had in dealing with the problem of what you would call moral hazard today. They would actually investigate these claims. It wasn't just investigation. They would send a sick committee over to help you out if you needed help. And then later, a lot of these organizations started to get more elaborate, started to build hospitals. Some of the black organizations had, in the South had some quite well-financed hospitals that provided health insurance, provided hospital care at very low rates through this kind of cooperative approach.
Now, you say here in the book that in the 1920s, maybe one out of three adult men would have been a lodge member, which is an astonishing figure. And when you add that to the number of people who were members of churches, which presumably also, in extreme cases, would provide various charitable services, you see various voluntary ways in which people took care of themselves. Now, when it comes to the The fraternal societies, though, in addition to the medical care aspect, what other benefits did people get? Was it did you get, for example, help with burial if there was an unexpected death, or was there something akin to unemployment insurance?
Well, the standard, you know, a standard feature would be burial insurance. Sometimes it'd be quite a lot of, you know, it'd be far more than the cost of the burial. But that was usually the poor, right, would be providing that. Most organizations did that. And then they would piggyback on top of that other services, including the sick benefits that I described to you, including the hospitals. One of the groups that did that that I found particularly fascinating was a black organization called the Knights and Daughters of Tabor, which had been, you know, formed in like the 1870s by freed slaves. Apparently, it had been originally a slave resistance, kind of grew out of a slave, an attempt to foment slave revolt in the 1850s. And these guys got together again in the 1870s and they formed this group. Well, in Mississippi, they built a hospital that built brick by brick during the Great Depression. And was the leading hospital for blacks for many years in the Mississippi Delta. And they would provide health care, well, something like $8 a year. You could get 30 days of hospital care at the Taborian Hospital. And if you were to figure out what that would be now, I'm not even sure what it would be, but we're talking about less than $100 a year. Most of the members of this organization were sharecroppers, were people under the poverty line. No governmental money, and it was considered very good health care. They used the doctors, their interns were doctors from Meharry Medical School, so they were well-trained physicians.
Well, this seems like a good time to backtrack a bit and talk about the way in which the fraternal societies seem to have played a more substantial role in the history of American blacks than of whites, as you say. What's
Native whites anyway?
Okay, because there were immigrant
groups.
Some
of the immigrant
right.
groups were pretty extensive, but
right.
among, you know, Native whites, I would say that's definitely the case.
Okay, so how do
compare the two groups?
Okay, so what kind of evidence do we have for this, and what kind of explanation do you suspect would account for it?
Well, we have statistical evidence that blacks were more likely to own life insurance, for example, than whites were. An amazing figure when you consider how dirt poor, as you know, blacks were in the early 20th century. These are people that primarily are, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, domestic service very often, unskilled labor, seasonal work. Yet I was just amazed by looking at some, you know, studies that were done city after city during the Progressive era, interestingly enough, so we can thank the progressives for this, because they did these block studies trying to show, gee, people don't have insurance. And they would divide it by ethnic group or by class, and consistently 90% or more of blacks would own life insurance, you know, higher than any other group. A significant percentage of that, not all of it, but a significant percentage of that was through lodges. We have all sorts of commentary from various anthropologists, sociologists that studied it, that, in fact, Gunnar Myrdal, Swedish economist, complained. He said, this is a problem among blacks. They've got too many social organizations. It takes all of their time. They can't get anything done. They're always going to meetings all of the time. And people would use expressions like that blacks were lodge mad. And, of course, we have satire, Amos and Andy. A big theme of Amos and Andy, again, this is done by whites, but, you know, it resonated, including among a very extensive black audience, because the major part of Amos and Andy was, the main characters going to the lodge meeting, the Mystic Knights of the Sea. And so this was commented upon a lot.
Now, this is a major part, then, of the cultural and economic history of American blacks, and yet here comes a fat softball right over the plate, David. Why do you think this aspect of that history is simply ignored, downplayed, not talked about?
Well, I think you've got a certain template. you know, that we call the Holy Trinity, and I think you know what I'm talking about, race, class, and gender. And historians are sort of forced into that. Even if they don't want to do it, they've got to sort of bow down to it to some extent, right? And it is, you know, class would certainly be, you know, let's find an organization where the whole point of it is, you know, one class trying to fight another class. Well, fraternal societies aren't of interest. That's your mentality, because every fraternal society, black, white, immigrant, that I know of, just about every, maybe you could find some weird exceptions, said, we want everybody to join. We're not going to discriminate on the basis of class. And, you know, they wanted people, you know, in fact, they bragged about it, that you might have a meeting where you have the factory owner as a lowly initiate, and the laborer who, you know, the janitor in the factory is the guy that is, you know, presiding over the meeting where he's trying to join. So it blows that away. Well, race, I suppose, but these groups, you know, you find among every race. You find black organizations, white organizations, immigrant organizations, and they look very much the same. Gender, well, I suppose some of these are male organizations, but again, if you look among blacks, for example, a lot of the immigrants, I would argue that among blacks, most members of fraternal organizations, at least a lot of them, well, that's, I think that actually that is true, are women. So it confounds the effort of that historians like to make to divide people, and because these folks don't act the way they're supposed to act.
Now that is an interesting. I was not expecting that. I like when I have a guest where I get an answer I'm not expecting. That's good, because I was thinking more in terms of these lodges and the type of work that's being done in them are examples of spontaneous and voluntary institutions, and they don't involve government, which is the normal story of how different groups have advanced or provided for themselves.
Well, I think that actually, I would rank that highly, although I think historians are a bit more interested in charity. But then again, it's often a negative take about how inadequate it is. But we do have, I think, a lot more work done on sort of a lot of charity societies and charity organizations, but it tends to be very negative. But I think you're absolutely right about that that's a lot of it. They're not demanding revolution, right? They're just trying to solve problems. They're not organizing people to overthrow the system. And so a lot of historians kind of look down on them like, well, gee, why aren't they interested in revolution? You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So that's bad, too, from that standpoint. But I think you're right that that's a key part of it.
No.
It's confounding, because far more workers belong to lodges. You're interested in working class history than unions, far more. So why don't we look at what the workers actually belong to? Well, I think I've given you some possible reasons why they're not interested. Historians are not interested.
Right. Why does your study end in 1967 in particular? It has to end sometime.
Well,
I guess.
I don't know. That's just sort of seems a little awkward. But what happens in 1967 is I have a chapter on this Taborian Hospital, which from, I guess, our standpoint of a libertarian outlook has a kind of tragic ending. Well, what happens is it's taken over along with a competing fraternal hospital by the OEO, by the, you know, the Great Society program. And that happens in 1967. And it basically, it becomes a rather sad shadow of itself after that, and finally it closes down. I do discuss a little bit after 1967, but that's sort of the main explanation, because I have a whole chapter on this rich history of healthcare in the Mississippi Delta, which is where most blacks lived in Mississippi, and what happens to this hospital. And there was another hospital as well in Mississippi as well that I look at. There were two, or three actually, that I look at.
Now, it seems to me that you could imagine a libertarian expecting that with the Great Society coming along and the government taking over a lot of the functions that have been carried out by the fraternal societies, that that would be one of the precipitating factors in their decline in this area. But if I remember your work correctly, you sort of suggest that it's not quite that simple, that yes, that certainly seems to have played a role, but that the real story is muddier than that. Am I right?
Yeah, it's always muddy. And, you know, and as a historian, I think you might appreciate that history is messy. And sometimes non-historians trying to get into it want a simple answer. And I think there's a lot of things going on. I think in the case of the fraternal societies and the medical care, you need to look at the role of groups like the American Medical Association, which engaged in a very ruthless campaign using the state, using the certification and licensing arm of the state, tried to reduce the number of doctors quite successfully in the early 20th century, including the numbers of black doctors, the numbers of black medical schools, and so forth. One of the reasons why lodge practice thrived is you had a big supply of doctors. Well, if you could impose what the AMA called birth control on the medical profession, which they were able to do, you make it much more difficult for these lodges to find doctors. And the AMA would just go waste all-out war on what they called the lodge upheaval. They would say, don't consult with lodge physicians. Don't deal with them. You know, they're trying to depress our fees to levels with a boot black and peanut vendor, and we have to stop them at all costs. So there was an effort to smash that, I think, definitely, that occurs. In the case of Mississippi, the fraternal hospitals there, I think I have strong evidence that the state regulatory authorities was tremendously destructive. And what they were constantly harassing these hospitals with rather petty regulations, and you know, things like you don't have enough certified employees, your ceilings are cane fiber, they can't be cane fiber, they got to be something else, and constant harassment. What also does happen certainly is the rise of things like Medicare and Medicaid, which and the third-party payment system, which it takes away a lot of the potential patient base. Because if you're getting medical care anyway through your employer, or you're getting it through Medicaid, or you're getting it through Medicare, well, you know, and you're barely getting by, you're going to sacrifice those dues that you're paying for fraternal societies. And, of course, I think there are social changes. One could argue that a lot of this, a lot of the fraternal model has to compete with new forms of entertainment that comes along, movies and that kind of thing. So I think that's a factor. But again, I look at this as an example of how resourceful people are. And I think given incentives, people would find, new ways to adapt this model, to sort of fit changing, social norms.
Well, David, I can't tell you how excited I am about this particular. I mean, even though this book came out probably in around the year 2000, is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
All right. Well, it needs an audience 8 gazillion times bigger than whatever the audience was, because it's the sort of question everybody has implicitly. What would people do? What did people do? And you have given a very substantial chunk of the answer here. And I think this is, just my own prejudices here are that this is probably one of the most interesting programs I've done. So I'm grateful to you for that. I'm going to encourage people to check out the book From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State by David Baido. And we will have to have you back on again to talk about another book.
All right. That sounds great. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. All right. That's the program for today. My thanks to you guys for listening in, for subscribing to the program on iTunes and Stitcher, and for helping us pay our bills by entering Amazon through the Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. And at no cost to you, you can help us keep this little Tom Woods show office. All right, if all goes well, it'll be the Pope Francis program tomorrow. He will not be a guest, but I'll be talking about what he had to say about capitalism. See you guys tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.